If we consider the psychology of international relationship as we see it manifested in the world about us, and as it's shown by the development of the power idea in modern Europe, we shall realize certain historically very important facts about the nature of man. Aristotle said that man is a political animal, but in our modern sense of the word politics, which now covers world politics, he's nothing of the sort. He has still the instincts of the family tribe, and beyond that he has a disposition to attach himself and his family to something larger, to a tribe, a city, a nation, or a state. But that disposition, left to itself, is a vague and very uncritical disposition. If anything, he's inclined to fear and dislike criticism of this something larger that encloses his life and to which he's given himself, and to avoid such criticism. Perhaps he has a subconscious fear of the isolation that may ensue if the system is broken or discredited. He takes the milieu in which he finds himself for granted. He accepts his city or his government just as he accepts the nose or the digestion which fortune has bestowed upon him. But men's loyalties, the sides they take in political things, are not innate. They are educational results. For most men, their education in these matters is the silent, continuous education of things about them. Men find themselves a part of Merry England or Holy Russia. They grow up into these devotions. They accept them as a part of their nature. It's only slowly that the world is beginning to realize how profoundly the tacit education of circumstances can be supplemented, modified, or corrected by positive teaching, by literature, discussion, and properly criticized experience. The real life of the ordinary man is his everyday life, his little circle of affections, fears, hungers, lusts, and imaginative impulses. It's only when his attention is directed to political affairs as something vitally affecting this personal circle that he brings his reluctant mind to bear upon them. It's scarcely too much to say that the ordinary man thinks as little about political matters as he can, and stops thinking about them as soon as possible. It's still only very curious and exceptional minds, or minds that have, by example or good education, acquired the scientific habit of wanting to know why, or minds shocked and distressed by some public catastrophe and roused to wide apprehensions of danger, that won't accept governments and institutions, however preposterous, that don't directly annoy them, as satisfactory. The ordinary human being, until he's so aroused, will acquiesce in any collective activities that are going on in this world in which he finds himself, and any phrasing or symbolization that meets his vague need for something greater to which his personal affairs, his individual circle, can be anchored. If we keep these manifest limitations of our nature in mind, it no longer becomes a mystery how, as the idea of Christianity as a world brotherhood of men sank into discredit because of its fatal entanglement with priestcraft and the papacy on the one hand, and with the authority of princes on the other, and the age of faith passed into our present age of doubt and disbelief, men shifted the reference of their lives from the kingdom of God and the brotherhood of mankind to these apparently more living realities, France and England, Holy Russia, Spain, Prussia, which were at least embodied in active courts, which maintained laws, exerted power through armies and navies, waved flags with a compelling solemnity, and were self-assertive and insatiably greedy in an entirely human and understandable fashion. Certainly such men as Cardinal Richelieu and Cardinal Mazarin thought of themselves as serving greater ends than their own or their monarchs. They served the quasi-divine France of their imaginations. And as certainly these habits of mind percolated down from them to their subordinates and to the general body of the population. In the 13th and 14th centuries, the great population of Europe was religious and only vaguely patriotic. By the 19th, it had become wholly patriotic. in a crowded English or French or German railway carriage of the later 19th century, it would have aroused far less hostility to have jeered at God than to have jeered at one of those strange beings, England, or France, or Germany. To these things men's minds clung, and they clung to them because in all the world there appeared nothing else so satisfying to cling to. They were the real and living gods of Europe. This idealization of governments and foreign offices, this mythology of powers and their loves and hates and conflicts, has so obsessed the imaginations of Europe and Western Asia as to provide it with its forms of thought. Nearly all the histories, nearly all the political literature of the last two centuries in Europe have been written in its phraseology. Yet a time is coming when a clear-sighted generation will read with perplexity how in the community of Western Europe, consisting everywhere of very slight variations of a common racial mixture of Nordic and Iberian peoples and immigrant Semitic and Mongolian elements, speaking nearly everywhere modifications of the same Aryan speech, having a common past in the Roman Empire, common religious forms, common social usages, and a common art and science, and intermarrying so freely that no one could tell with certainty the nationality of any of his great-grandchildren, men could be moved to the wildest excitement upon the question of the ascendancy of France, the rise and unification of Germany, the rival claims of Russia and Greece to possess Constantinople. These conflicts will seem then as reasonless and insane as those dead, now incomprehensible feuds of the greens and blues that once filled the streets of Byzantium with shouting and bloodshed. Tremendously as these phantoms, the powers, rule our minds and lives today, they are, as this history shows clearly, things only of the last few centuries, a mere hour, an incidental phase in the vast, deliberate history of our kind. They mark a phase of relapse, a backwater, as the rise of Machiavellian monarchy marks a backwater. They are part of the same eddy of faltering faith, in a process altogether greater and altogether different in its general tendency, the process of the moral and intellectual reunion of mankind. For a time, men have relapsed upon these national or imperial gods of theirs. It is but for a time. The idea of the world state, the universal kingdom of righteousness of which every living soul shall be a citizen, was already in the world 2,000 years ago, never more to leave it. Men know that it's present, even when they refuse to recognize it. In the writings and talk of men about international affairs today, in the current discussions of historians and political journalists, there's an effect of drunken men growing sober, and terribly afraid of growing sober. They still talk loudly of their love for France, of their hatred of Germany, of the traditional ascendancy of Britain at sea, and so on, like those who sing of their cups, in spite of the steadfast onset of sobriety and a headache. These are dead gods they serve. By sea or land, men want no powers ascendant, but only law and service. That silent, unavoidable challenge is in all our minds, like dawn breaking slowly, shining between the shutters of a disordered room. 7th. The 17th century in Europe was the century of Louis XIV. He and French ascendancy and Versailles are the central motif of the story. The 18th century was equally the century of the rise of Prussia as a great power, and the chief figure in the story is Frederick II, Frederick the Great. Interwoven with his history is the story of Poland.